Hello and welcome to Brexit Republic, RTE's podcast on Brexit. I'm Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor in Brussels.
And I'm Fiona Mitchell, RTE's London correspondent.
And I'm Sean Whelan, RTE's economics correspondent, standing in for Colm O'Mungon. Each week, Brexit Republic assesses all the latest Brexit developments in Brussels, London and Dublin.
Has Theresa May finally run out of road? We look at how her backbenchers may have prized her fingers off the door handle of number 10.
But who might replace her and when? And what will it mean for the Brexit process and the future of the Tory party?
And as one door slams shut, another door also slams shut. As expected, the cross-party talks between Labour and the Conservatives have finally bit the dust, leaving Theresa May with just one more throw of the dice to get the withdrawal agreement over the line in the House of Commons.
It's a long shot, but we will look at how the withdrawal agreement bill, or WAB for short, might play out and what risks it might pose to the backstop.
And we'll take the temperature in Brussels as the EU looks on with what one senior official calls suspended disbelief.
But first, yet another difficult week for Theresa May. So let's start in London with Fiona, because you have the closest thing to actual news on the Brexit front happening on your patch. Bring us up to speed.
Yes, it's been a week of surprises that weren't really surprises, Sean, if you like. We have the announcement by Labour on Friday that the talks, which have been ongoing for 6 weeks now with the government to try and find some sort of compromise, some sort of middle ground, something that might get a Brexit deal through a parliamentary vote. It was officially announced that those talks were declared dead in the water. Labour said that they'd really reached the end of the road. No agreement was going to be possible. Now, as I say, that's a surprise that wasn't really a surprise. It had been touted many times in the last few weeks, and on both sides of the political divide, Tories and Labour MPs very angry, many of them, about the fact that those talks are taking place. Now, no sooner, of course, had Jeremy Corbyn announced that he'd written a letter to Theresa May saying, that's it, no point in continuing on with this. And of course, the blame game started. Labour talked about the fact that Theresa May this week has edged closer to that final date of departure really means that for them, there's not much point in doing any talks with her, that the gaps were still too wide, but that even essentially if they do a deal with Theresa May, well, in a few weeks' time, you're looking at a new leader who could throw everything out. And that was a point that Jeremy Corbyn made when he said that he's already hearing lots of cabinet members coming out into the political arena or into the media talking about the fact that they, you know, just don't agree with what's going on. So he said he just doesn't know what he would end up essentially dealing with. Theresa May, of course, coming out and saying, yes, there were lots of ways in which we could have agreed, but that Labour couldn't seem to make up its mind about a second referendum. Did it want one? Is that Labour policy? Nobody really knew. So the blame game well underway. You can expect that to continue.
Can I ask you about the outcome of these talks? I mean, there is no outcome, obviously, but Corbyn's letter this morning talked about without considerable changes, we will continue to oppose the deal. So effectively, nothing has changed at all. We're back to where we were 6 weeks ago, at the very least.
Yes, we're back to absolute stalemate. Now, we did find out this week that Theresa May intends to bring the withdrawal bill back to the Commons or to the Commons in the first week of June. That isn't essentially, it's being billed, of course, as a fourth vote on her Brexit deal. It's slightly different insofar as it's not the straightforward vote that she has put to MPs before and has had roundly rejected on those occasions. So this is slightly different, but it is essentially the same thing is what it boils down to, because if she can't manage to get this bill through, well, then she has absolutely no hope for that deal itself. So everybody's seeing this as essentially a fourth go at this, and really the numbers do not seem to have changed. Now, while some movement has happened this week politically, it's not really at the moment it would look like the kind of movement that she needs, because we know she had yet another crunch showdown meeting with the 1922 committee, pretty much a weekly event at this point. But she did say in that she would set out a date for her departure. And so really everybody just believes we're in the last weeks of Theresa May's premiership at this point, something again that we have been saying for the best part of 2 years now. But it looks like this really is the final stages for her. That stalemate on all sides means she's very little room for manoeuvre. If that bill comes back and is roundly rejected, as everybody expects in the first week of June, she then, within hours or certainly days of that, has to go back and have another conversation with the 1922 committee. And at that point, everybody just feels it is game over. So given that everybody is acting essentially as if it's game over already, you can imagine that the leadership campaign, which has been well underway for months, albeit on a very unofficial level, is really ramping up a gear in recent days. And you can expect that to see, you can expect to see that just absolutely continue.
But before we get into any Labour leadership issues, the long goodbye of Theresa May. I mean, I remember freezing my backside off standing beside the Thames last year talking about Theresa May being assailed by the 1922 committee and various people coming out on television and radio saying that the end was nigh, imminently, within days, within hours, she will be gone. Are we sure at all that we are into the final days of Theresa May at this stage, or is it just yet another final days in the Brexit sense of final days, meaning, of course, it's not the final days, that this thing could actually go on into the autumn?
Well, of course, I think at this point, when I go to start typing out the words, the end of Theresa May's premiership, my computer almost does it automatically at this point, because as you say, on so many occasions, we have thought that this is game over. And then it turns out that somehow she manages to find another way to hang on for a while longer. But really, the truth of it is, everybody, that widespread acknowledgement, even by really staunch allies of Theresa May, just acknowledging at this point that there's no more moves to make on this. I mean, those talks with Labour were very much a last-ditch effort. There's some talk of more indicative votes. Yes, the dreaded word, indicative votes. We'll come back to that. There's some talk of that, but again, nobody expects anything particularly successful to come out of that. Nobody believes at this point that Theresa May is going to be able to get a deal over the line. And frankly, at this point, she is quite clearly a very significant part of the problem. So something has to happen in order to budge that, to move that. And of course, there's been so many moves against her within her own party. I think, as I say, that on every side at this point, they know that really this is the last thing that they have, any hope that they have of moving this process forward, though that is certainly by no means a given. She's going to be heading into a very busy month of June, facing the end of her premiership, facing a Donald Trump visit, facing that withdrawal bill in the House of Commons, a key vote in relation to that, facing another meeting with the 1922 committee. Everybody just feels that probably by the end of June, she will certainly be gone, and that leadership campaign will be well underway. But whoever comes in after her faces exactly the same problems, because the maths has not changed. And it's that maths in the House of Commons which has made it impossible to get any kind of deal through. Now, the belief that it will be a Brexiteer might change that somewhat, but I think really you can expect to see whoever comes in inevitably being pushed about whether or not they want to call a general election, because if they want any room for manoeuvre in the House of Commons, they probably have to try and change the maths around, and the only way to do that is a general election.
Can I just ask you one brief technical point here about this vote on the withdrawal bill? Are people sure that it's Speaker Bercow proof, that no precedent from 1604 or some other period way back in the dark periods of history will be produced to try and put this vote off for a longer period again?
Well, as I say, that's an element of this that Theresa May has had to deal with in the past. And this vote is slightly different to what has gone before, because that was a straightforward vote on Theresa May's deal on the withdrawal treaty that had been brought back from those talks in Brussels. Whereas this is a vote on a much broader legislation that would be needed to get Brexit onto the statute books and get it all sorted and done before the end of the summer and before that summer recess begins. So that has if you like, kind of tried to proof it against the speaker already, and that is already built in, because there was serious doubts, of course, as to whether or not he would have allowed another run at that vote, and an awful lot of people, I think, in Downing Street starting to feel he probably wouldn't have. So this becomes another vote on the Brexit deal, but slightly different to how it went before, which means that at least it can get into the House of Commons. Getting through the House of Commons, well, now that's an entirely different kettle of fish.
So, Tony, once again, it's the end of Theresa May, and once again, it's time for a crucial parliamentary vote on Brexit. So, just another normal week in Westminster then, or is it? How's all this being seen in Brussels and the other EU capitals?
Well, people have written off Theresa May so often over the past couple of years, but yet she seemed to have walked through fire and kept coming back time and time again. And while there has been enormous frustration at Theresa May's performance in the Brexit negotiations, you inevitably have had expressions of admiration for her tenacity, her doggedness, and also, I think, other leaders have felt that she has actually acted in good faith, no matter what the difficulties of the negotiations have been. They have also regarded her as really being not well prepared, poorly advised, not really, when it counted, able to come with a convincing, passionate argument that might help her with her Eurosceptics in Westminster. We've seen so often that landmark summits like the Salzburg summit last September turned out to be a disaster for Theresa May, because the level at which she pitched her argument, the style in which she did it, really fell short. So people, while they talked about her tenacity and her other qualities, always felt that she simply couldn't deliver, and they could no longer depend on her to deliver. Now, the follow-up thinking in Brussels and in other capitals has always been, well, if she was to be defenestrated, who would replace her that would be any more credible, given that the dysfunction, if you like, in Theresa May's argumentation simply reflects the dysfunction in Westminster and the Conservative Party over what is realistically possible from the other member states in the Brexit negotiations. So we now see ourselves in a situation where the most likely successor, Theresa May, is going to be a hard Brexiteer, because of the way the succession process is structured. It goes through the parliamentary party. We have something like 17 candidates, and the runoff between the top two candidates is decided by the grassroots. And of course, the mood in the grassroots has shifted to the right on Brexit. They are much more gung-ho about no deal. And so EU leaders and the institutions have been quietly factoring that in. And they can see a fairly clear sequence of events in the coming months. They expect the Conservative Party to have a quick succession as quickly as possible, preferably before the summer recess, so that they could gather their team about them in August and then be in place for the Conservative Party conference at the end of September into October, and then confront the EU once again. Now, the assumption is this will either be a Boris Johnson or a Dominic Raab. And because the centre ground in this process has been largely vacated, people are fleeing to the extremes in both parties. It is already seen in Brussels and the other capitals that the new Prime Minister will have very little room for manoeuvre. Their political margins will be a lot tighter going into any meeting with the EU after the Tory party conference, because of the mood in the party and because of the fact that they will have had to campaign in the election campaign for the successor to Theresa May along on a fairly hard Brexit ticket. It's been described as something as an arms race in the rhetoric of this contest.
But as you point out, Tony, I mean, changing the leader doesn't change the internal fissures within the Conservative Party and indeed the Labour Party as well. The inability of these groups to come together, and as Fiona has pointed out, it doesn't change the parliamentary arithmetic one jot. It's still the same number of members of parliament who are in there. So whoever becomes leader, and let's, you know, conjecture it might well be Boris Johnson, because he surprised absolutely nobody except his own staff, apparently, when he declared his intention to stand for that leadership contest this week. In some ways, he's the quintessential EU insider, son of a Eurocrat, posh education at the European School of Brussels before going to Eton, sort of reverse Duke of Wellington, Turkish ancestors, offspring enjoying the Erasmus programme, utterly Euro elite, surely. Boris, as Prime Minister, surely he's going to get a sympathetic hearing from the European Council, his first one it will be, if he asks for an extension to Article 50 deadline at his summit in October, because that is what they're looking at, is it not? Even if they go into this quick fire process that you describe, with so many contenders, with such a difficult race ahead, there isn't really much time for them to do anything before that hard deadline of the 31st of October.
Well, you're right in that Boris Johnson does have this provenance in Brussels, and given his father's career there, and also his own career as a journalist, you know, he was a notoriously colourful reporter of the EU scene for the Daily Telegraph, I think it was, and then the Spectator. But you know, his track record throughout the Brexit process has been anything but you know, credible from an EU point of view. He appeared to vacillate between leave and remain before the referendum itself. And then since then, he has come out with some very insulting remarks about the EU, and the EU could go whistle if they thought they were getting a penny from the UK, towing a fairly colourful but obdurate hard line from the Brexit corner. So I don't really think he's going to be regarded with any sense of relief after the Theresa May era. And also, you would have to anticipate him being corralled along a very hard line Brexit path in his journey to his first European Council in October, if indeed Boris Johnson does get the job. There could be other contenders who might suddenly emerge in the pack. But if we're talking about Johnson, you know, he's going to be going to the European Council fresh from a Conservative Party conference, where he will be expected to ring the changes, declare his hard Brexit credentials, show the world that he's sweeping away the failed, feeble negotiating efforts of Theresa May. And so I think it would be very difficult for him to start his premiership by signalling that, actually, in reality, guys, I'm going to have to seek an extension, because a no-deal scenario is not what the House of Commons, because of its arithmetic, is going to accept. So it will be what one official I spoke to today described as a very bruising autumn, a very rough period running up to the European Council in October. But you would have to say that, you know, given the atmospherics of the leadership campaign and the expectations from the party conference, Boris Johnson is going to have to show some muscle, in his own words, put lead in the pencil, etc., all of those other libidinous metaphors that we've heard over the past couple of years from him, if he is going to make a mark in the Conservative Party, because nobody there wants a sudden landing back to earth in such a short period of time. So the question then is, will the EU be prepared to talk Turkey with him? It seems inconceivable that if he comes up and charges the ramparts, demanding that the backstop be torn out, that the EU will give him a sympathetic hearing. That doesn't seem credible at all. So then we are faced with a the alternative to that, which he will be under pressure to say, is a no-deal situation by the end of the year, perhaps. Or if then the House of Commons says, well, that's out of the question because we object to that, then he's going to have to go back and look for an extension. Again, these options are fairly narrow at this stage.
They are. But do you think Leo Varadkar may have opened the door there with a not very well commented on remark he made about the possibility of Britain being involved in either the customs union or a customs union, but with a say on how the EU conducts its trade deals with the rest of the world? Is that something that might come back into the equation later on? Is that something that a new Conservative Party leader might cling on to as a way of negotiating through some change to this withdrawal agreement that might satisfy enough of the broadly Remainer or close to the EU people and enough of the pro-Brexit people in the Parliament to get a slightly tweaked withdrawal agreement through?
Well, this nicely comes to the counterfactual of Boris Johnson, say, if he gets appointed as leader, and of course he's the favourite among the Tory grassroots. The counterfactual is that in order to avoid the beginning of his premiership being tainted by the slamming door in Brussels and the humiliation of another extension, that he might suddenly say, well, let's endorse this withdrawal agreement. Let's show that we've actually delivered Brexit. And remember, the Tories will have taken a hammering in the European Parliament elections. And I can then, as the new Tory leader, hit the ground running and be a much better negotiator. But in the next phase of the negotiations, Brexit will have happened. The EU, the UK will be on its way out. Apart from the transition period, but then he can beat his chest and show that he'll be a much better negotiator than Theresa May when it comes to the trade negotiations. And in that arena, you know, all sorts of things are up for grabs. And that, of course, is reflective in the fact that the political declaration can be tweaked in the next couple of weeks. Ollie Robbins, the Theresa May Sherpa and lead negotiator, was in Brussels last week talking to officials about how the political declaration might be moved around to reflect perhaps a nascent deal with the Labour Party. Of course, the Labour Party has been looking for a permanent customs union. Those talks have collapsed, but obviously that is a demand that's still in the mix if Labour is going to help the Conservatives get this thing over the line in the House of Commons. So, yes, I mean, all of those things are up for grabs, and that might have been Leo Varadkar just floating something that may have been smuggled through back channels from London as to something that might just be a little appetizer for people who might think, well, okay, we hate the withdrawal agreement, but at least if we accept it and it's Brexit has happened, we've got it over the line, we've swallowed our tongue, but now we're going to, you know, roll up our sleeves, beat our chests and go into the trade negotiations. And something like that could be fertile ground for those kind of ideas.
Which brings us to the withdrawal agreement bill, or WAB, as you're calling it now. It's a new one on me, I have to admit. But it would be doing the next leader of the Conservative Party a favour if Theresa May is actually able to get through, get this bill through or approved by the House of Commons in June and getting it off the table so that people can move on to this brave new set of new negotiations and bringing in all kinds of new ideas and trying to distance themselves from the past. But of course, we still have to actually see the House of Commons endorsing this withdrawal agreement bill. What's your understanding of this voting process that's going to happen, due to happen in the first week of June? And also maybe tell us about this theory you have about it, the potential threat it might pose to the backstop.
Yes, I mean, there is a bit of confusion, I suppose, because we talk about the withdrawal agreement and the fact that she's tried three times to get it through the House of Commons and has failed on each occasion. And now she's having a fourth throw of the dice at the 11th hour, just before she is thrown out of the party as leader. What we've had so far reflects the EU Withdrawal Act. Now, Article 13 of the EU Withdrawal Act requires the House of Commons to give a meaningful vote on the final deal. Now, we've had three meaningful votes so far. As we know, the first was defeated in January by 230 votes. The second on March 12th was defeated by 149 votes. And then the last one was defeated by 68 votes. Now, the last one was somewhat different because you'll remember that John Bercow, the Speaker of the House, said that you couldn't bring the same bill to the House of Commons for a third time. So what they did was they decoupled the withdrawal agreement, the divorce treaty itself, from the political declaration. Because remember, in the first two votes, they were voting for both as a package. In the third one, they just voted on the withdrawal agreement itself. And you'll remember that the Attorney General, Geoffrey Cox, was meant to deliver a form of words which reassured people that you could get out of the backstop. Of course, he declined to do that, and the thing went down again by 68 votes. Now, what they're trying to look at on this occasion is, rather than put the withdrawal agreement per se before the House of Commons for a fourth time, they would instead introduce a bill that would legislate for the withdrawal agreement coming into effect, because of course the divorce treaty must be enshrined in domestic UK legislation. So you would have a huge thick folder of clauses and amendments that would be this withdrawal agreement bill. That will have to be done anyway if Britain is to leave with an orderly departure. So what they would be doing is saying, well, let's just put aside the withdrawal agreement itself per se and just vote on the legislation that would give effect to the withdrawal agreement. And they can put clauses in here and there which effectively say that this takes care of the meaningful vote requirement of Article 13 of the Withdrawal Act. So it's a bit of fancy footwork. But the advantage, I suppose, from a rather desperate number 10, Downing Street, is that it gives MPs clear, detailed positions on what they would be voting for, what the withdrawal agreement would mean for UK law, all of the different key elements of the departure of the UK, the citizens' rights, the financial settlement, the backstop. All of these would be given clear, unambiguous legal text and clarity. Now, the other advantage, if you like, for the optimists who are looking at this, and of course there are very few of them left in the room, but it would, that you could have lots of amendments added to this bill, which would try and once again take the temperature of the House of Commons. You could have amendments on a permanent customs union. You could have amendments on workers' rights and the environment. You could have amendments that require the House of Commons to have a much closer involvement in the trade negotiations, stuff that MPs might actually like. And again, if you're trying to appeal to the soft Brexiteers who are terrified of Nigel Farage and the Brexit Party, who are given a last chance to actually deliver Brexit, which, according to the Conservative narrative, is what the voters now want. You know, this is your opportunity, and you could add stuff that give you some comfort. Now, some of the amendments I spoke about there are things that Labour want. You could have amendments that the Brexiteers want, such as, a greater role for the House of Commons. You could have stuff like the Swire Amendment from back in December, which says Parliament has to vote when the backstop comes into effect. And this brings us to your question about what risks this might pose, because you could have clauses and amendments in there which say the backstop might have conditions attached. There might be, again, the sunset clause, a termination date. All of the stuff that we thought was over and done with, they could creep back into the whole process of this withdrawal agreement bill. And that, of course, would then mean it just runs into real trouble from a European perspective and an Irish perspective. And again, hanging over this process is this fear that a future Tory leader, perhaps Boris Johnson, could, to try and backslide on the commitments of the withdrawal agreement. But of course, none of that would fly, and the EU would look at this and say, well, look, we've seen these amendments in this withdrawal agreement bill, And it's clear that this country is simply not serious when it comes to ratifying this international treaty.
Well, I was about to ask you there, Tony. I mean, it's all jolly nice for the backbenchers in the Palace of Westminster to be coming up with all kinds of things that suit themselves. But does that route that you've described there actually constitute ratification of an international agreement in terms that the EU would understand it as?
Well, that's an excellent question. They are looking at this to see if simply by passing the withdrawal agreement bill, is that the exact same thing as ratifying an international treaty? And of course, because it's this kind of organic thing where you can add ingredients here and there, you could put in a clause to say that this has the effect of the House of Commons ratifying a treaty. If you got into any ambiguity about that, then it would be majorly problematic for the EU, because of course the law of an international treaty, if a country has signed up to it, will supersede any subsequent domestic legislation that is counter to it, and that's going to be the bottom line as far as the EU is concerned. But of course, I mean, we have to qualify all of this conversation we're having by repeating the line that this is really Theresa May's last throw of the dice, and this is a very optimistic reading of it.
Tony, is that reading not, though, a bit over-optimistic, perhaps, that this thing is going to get sorted out in this almost Harry Potter-ish way of people being able to add in things any way they want? It's really not proper ratification as we understand it in EU terms, is it? I mean, we're expecting a rubber stamp, effectively, a yes or a no to this agreement, not something as convoluted as you've been describing. Surely that's not optimistic.
No, it's not optimistic, and the people who are exploring these ideas, you know, are really pushing the boundaries of optimism. I think simply because it's Theresa May's last throw of the dice that they're just looking at, you know, what, if anything, might come out of this. But I would say that there are people who believe that because the Conservatives are going to get so hammered in the European Parliament elections, that, you know, if the resounding message from the pro-Brexit electorate is that the Tories have failed to deliver Brexit, here is their chance finally at the last gasp, you know, injury time, to get this over the line and to deliver Brexit. So you could say that, you know, there are incentives for the Conservative Party to look at this seriously, and there may be some sweeteners in there for Labour, but you would have to say that given the mood in Westminster, it doesn't look likely. But then again, getting back to that idea that a new Conservative leader does not want to be, you know, bequeathed this huge mess, where his only option is for a no deal, which would be a catastrophe for the UK economy.
So coming back to you in London, Fiona, this Conservative Party leadership contest, which, as you said earlier, has been going on seemingly forever now, but certainly for 5 or 6 months now. What's the latest developments there, apart from the very obvious entry of Boris Johnson into the leadership campaign and the non-surprise of the week?
Yes, yet another surprise that wasn't a surprise when he told a group of business people in Manchester that, yes, he was throwing his hat into the ring. I mean, we've all known that for some time now, arguably for years now. So that was no surprise. But of course, the fact that this is all now ramped up and we really have a sense that we're in the final weeks means that every politician, every Tory party politician finds themselves besieged by photographers outside their front door as they head out to work in the morning. I mean, this looks like being potentially a very, very broad field. I mean, already a lot of the names being touted. You have, of course, Boris Johnson, Michael Gove, Liz Truss. You have potentially people like Jeremy Hunt would be seen as one of the front runners. You also have Dominic Raab. And then you have other voices within the cabinet who might not be as well known. One who has really just been appointed to the cabinet very recently, Rory Stewart, the International Development Minister, and of course we've Andrea Leadsom, also expected to run. So as I say, a very, very broad field, and for a lot of people in the Tory party who aren't running, or should I say the few who aren't running, they're saying, look, we need this to be a process that moves fairly swiftly, and so we need this to move quite fast. So you can imagine if you're talking about that many people on a hustings, you're going to have an awful lot to choose from. But ultimately, they first of all have to get through a series of voting through the Tory party MPs themselves. Then it goes, is narrowed down to two final contenders, and then it goes to the membership of the Tory party. So you have 100,000, an estimated 100,000, maybe slightly less than that, of Tory party members who will ultimately make the decision about who is going to be leader of the party and who is going to be the next prime minister. So it's a very small pool of people making a decision about a leader for a very large group of people, 64, 65 million people in the UK.
But quite a convoluted election process, as you say. And this is supposed to be wrapped up, according to the people who see these things in ideal world terms, by the parliamentary recess, so that the new leader of the party and presumably the new Prime Minister of the United Kingdom would have the summer break to try and get their ducks in a row for a very brisk and busy autumn ahead. Is that feasible, really, as a timetable? And when is that parliamentary recess?
Well, the parliamentary recess won't happen until later in July. Now, of course, the part of the difficulty with this is that the all the questions about how soon this could run, how soon it could start, how soon they could get it over with, that's all tied up with how soon Theresa May would intend to stand down. And until they have her timetable, they can't really look at another timetable around that. But as I say, there's a real sense that whoever gets in and gets started on this needs to do so very fast. Remember, there is a very, very important deadline of October 31st, which is that new Brexit deadline, which hoves into view. You also, of course, have the Conservative Party conference due to happen September, October, and a real sense that a leader should be in place at that point and have their feet under the table. But as I say, a lot of it is to do at this point with waiting for Theresa May. And once she says she's going, which a lot of people at this point hope is going to be very rapidly, once that happens, then the timetable can be set out a bit more in a bit more concrete kind of fashion.
You've also, of course, got Nigel Farage and his Brexit party putting the fear of God into Conservative MPs from the outside. You've been sampling the atmosphere at one of their rallies down in Wales. What impressions did you have of that party and also of the type of people that it's attracting to its banner?
Well, one of the striking things really about that, I went along to a rally in Merthyr Tydfil in Wales one evening this week, a lovely balmy evening, blazing sunshine, lots of people out, probably about 600, maybe 700 people drawn to that rally, paying their £2.50 a head to get in and listen to Nigel Farage. There were other people on the stage, it must be said, local candidates running in the European elections, but the truth be told, he was the only person I think that people really wanted to hear about. The Brexit party is the Nigel Farage party. It is very much branded like that. And one of the things that really, really struck me about it was the huge range of people. Having spoken to an awful lot of people who were there on the evening, Sean, you just got a real sense of how difficult it was to actually find a UKIP voter, somebody who had voted with him in the past. Lots of Labour voters, lots of Conservative voters, probably more Conservative voters, I would have to say, even than Labour, and all of them just of one mind, very, very angry with how they feel they have been treated by Westminster, just saying Westminster needs to get on with this process. Also, quite a few Remain voters amongst them, people who saying for various reasons they voted Remain. Maybe they weren't particularly on the side of Remain. You know, some people saying, I did it, but it was because of my children or my grandchildren. I didn't really want to throw them into the kind of uncertainty that I thought a Leave vote might bring. Now the Leave vote has happened. But you know what? I just think we need to get on with it anyway. So he's really attracting a broad spectrum of support. And that was something that you can see is really buoying up his campaign. And when I spoke to Nigel Farage himself just before he went on stage, he was adamant about that. He said, look, you know, this isn't a party that is born out of anger. And this isn't at the moment, of course, it is a one issue situation, but he is clearly a man who intends to be here to stay. Because as I said, well, if you get a Boris Johnson or Dominic Raab and they give you the kind of Brexit that you want, Presumably that affords you the opportunity to head back into retirement. But he has no intention of going anywhere. He says that basically you can't trust these guys. They didn't sign up to the kind of Brexit that they should have early enough. They haven't done enough to make it happen. And he's here to make sure that Westminster listens out from here on in. And quite frankly, he did have a sizable amount of support, as I say, at that rally. Although it was interesting, he did walk about in the town earlier when he arrived, and obviously at the rally, well, of course you're going to have your supporters there. On the walk about in the town in the high street, very, very quiet high street, it must be said, on the afternoon in question. That in itself is sort of a sign of the kind of quiet times that there are in places like Merthyr Tydfil, but not exactly a rapturous welcome from all. He certainly got some people saying he wasn't welcome there. One woman I spoke to came out to the door to see what was going on, because of course he is now followed by an absolute array of journalists from the UK and from across the world. One woman came out to the door of her shop and said, what's going on? When I said it was Nigel Farage, she just turned on her heel and walked back in and said to me, he is not the kind of politician I would support. So some not even wanting to come out on the street and welcome him or see what was going on. But he is certainly getting a lot of the headlines. And if the polls are to be believed, he is certainly getting a lot of the votes. And we will see that next week.
An array of journalists, as you said, and quite the contrast with Theresa May launching the European election campaign for the Conservative Party today. Just one political correspondent attending that, and one wire agency doing the pool for everybody else.
Perhaps most kindly described as low key, I think, is how we might box that one off. But it was quite a strange launch. Yes.
Yeah. And a YouGov poll also published the same day, Friday, showing the Brexit Party at 35%, the Liberal Democrats, the Remainer, the leading Remain voice, second place, but at 16%. Labour at 15%, the Greens at 10%, and the Conservatives at 9%. Change UK at 5% and UKIP down at 3%, even though there's not many of them to be found in Merthyr Tydfil. Fiona, thanks very much for that. But just before you go, what are you going to be looking forward to next week in Brexit land?
Well, obviously, of course, it'll be all eyes on the election itself taking place next Thursday. And what is happening in the run up to that in terms of campaigning? You mentioned, of course, that very low key launch of the Conservative Party campaign. But it'll be all eyes on whether or not any Conservative Party MPs and whether or not Theresa May is out and about and doing anything to try and get the figures out. It seems that really very little can be done at this stage. Also watching a couple of more polls that are expected. But as I say, it'll be keeping an eye on what's happening, because of course the speculation in Westminster now is that Theresa May is going to need to put all her effort into trying to pull together some votes ahead of the withdrawal bill coming to the House of Commons in early June. And she may be putting more energy into that over the course of the next week than she even is into that EU campaign.
And Tony, what's on the Brussels radar screen next week? Presumably those elections as well.
Yeah, so it's all the campaigning is going to be on the European elections across the EU. It's a massive story, obviously, because of the expected surge of the far right and the threat to the European Union from within. Perhaps if you follow some of the fear factor to its logical conclusion, the votes will start on Thursday, but they can take place in different on different days in different parts of the EU, with the results coming out on Sunday night. I think the official results start coming in at around 10 o'clock Irish time on Sunday night, 11 o'clock EU time. So that will be a fascinating thing to watch. And of course, Brexit is kind of hanging over that because of the fact that the UK is contesting these elections. And the Brexit problem is, of course, spilling over into the new European cycle. So that's really going to be the big talking point over the next week.
Great stuff, folks. Well, that's all we have time for from this edition of Brexit Republic. Colm O'Mungon will be back from Gaza next week to host the podcast. And yes, I know we said that last week as well, but in the finest traditions of Brexit, we weren't wholly truthful. Unlike Theresa May, I'm pretty sure I won't be around next week. But like the men in grey suits, Brexit Republic will be back. Enjoy.